inaugural wonderful lectures in the series that Professor Seeger is providing us. Actually, today's subject is a point where we professionally intersect historically in our involvement with the archives, the ASCE in India. And I think this will be particularly illuminating because Tony Seeger has actually done something that actually very few of these colleges have done, and that is to spend a very significant part of his professional career outside of academia in institutions devoted to archiving, transmission, preservation, and so forth of oral information. And these introductions have been very brief, for which I'm really quite embarrassed because I'm not a good introducer, but fortunately, as I've said, I think every time, Tony's not somebody who needs much of an introduction, but I didn't tell you this today, I'm giving a 20-minute introduction before we start. And it begins with the day he was born. I was there a year older.
That's right, you were
there. Thanks for coming. Welcome to the, I guess it's the third of the lectures I'm going to give, What Is It All For? And this presentation is going to take its context from the two previous ones I've given. If you weren't here, it doesn't matter, but if you were here, those are sort of the background for this. The first of the three I devoted to how involved my family's been in politics and music and various sort of oppressive movements and progressive movements in the United States, which definitely shaped the attitudes that I brought to the field and that I bring to my work ever since. So that's one part of the background. I was raised to think that we used our talents in this world and not for something abstract, but for actually something that made a difference in people's lives. That's how Charles Seeger, my grandfather, used his musicology. That's how Pete certainly used his music. And that's certainly how Peggy wrote the song she did. And Mike had a different kind of vision, but his vision was to use music to actually make other musicians and call attention to a kind of music that was being pretty much forgotten about in the United States. And an approach to performance that was both historical and research-based that was also not so common in the United States in the 1950s. So the family, as I said, that background of the family is certainly one of the reasons that I probably have done what I did, and will tell you what I'm going to say today. The second one, second lecture, explained sort of where I got my approach to ethnomusicology as evidenced in the book Why Suya Sing, which is an ethnography that many people have read. And it talked about how certain teachers were role models both to what I did as a researcher and also to how I worked. And the training I got in social anthropology, sociology, and social psychology, and the social sciences in general, certainly had an impact not only in how I did my research, but in what I did and how I did my applied ethnomusicology. It is not what I have done since is not apart from it. It's not as though I have my scholarship on the one hand and my applied ethnomusicology or my action in the world on the other. They're deeply interrelated, and I'm going to argue they should be deeply interrelated. I'm going to argue that the only good applied ethnomusicology has to be really good ethnomusicology. Okay, this week's song. I've started every time with a song because I think it's very deadly to come from lunch straight to a long lecture. I have each week a different T-shirt. But the weather hasn't really been collaborating. It hasn't really been T-shirt weather in California since I got here. I do have a different T-shirt. There are so many T-shirts for today's topic, I had to sort of rummage through three different drawers of T-shirts for today's topic. And I have a different song. I happen to like this song. I think probably like it more than anybody else. But you get a chance to hear it. It's a song written by my uncle Pete Seeger in the 1960s. And performed on an album of songs for Pete Seeger, a cover album of people covering his songs, published by Appleseed Records. Appleseed Records was actually founded
by a lawyer who worked with Ralph Nader in his pre-presidential days, a social activist, union organizer, who thought he would start a record label to represent his own ideas, just so that you realize you can start record labels on your own or other kinds of sort of jobs. And he's done a really nice job. I'm very jealous in some ways of what he could do as an individual as opposed to what I could do as part of the Smithsonian Institution. And there's a song on the second volume of that series of songs for Pete Seeger called Words, Words, Words. And it's sung by John Wesley Harding minus five. You go figure. I can't figure out how they had... There weren't five of them to start with, I don't think. And they've changed the song a bit from the way Pete did it, and I'm going to change it even more. We call it the folk process. Some people probably call it illegal, but... It has a part for you, and your part is, your line is, how much truth remains? Pete wrote, how much of truth remains, but that's a little complicated to sing. So just think, how much truth remains? And that's the way that John Wesley Harding does it. So your part goes, how much truth remains? How much truth remains? How much truth remains? It's a pretty short line, but it's probably the most important question we ask, right? I mean, this is the ultimate scholarly song, in the sense where your job is to ask how much truth remains. My job is to try to remember the verses, which I've not only altered, but I've completely created some new ones that you'll probably recognize. I've also, I think John Wesley Harding does this, it builds. The last chorus and the last response lines are different than the first ones. Words, 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 on cracked old pages, how much truth remains? If I only understood them as my lips pronounce them, would not my life be changed? Words, 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 in my old Bible, how much truth remains? If I only understood them as my lips pronounced them, would not my life be changed? Whoa! Oh, banjos, they're so much fun. Let's see. Somebody didn't like that verse. Let's see, is that going to go there? Now we're out of the Declaration of Independence. Words, 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 in the Declaration, how much truth remains? If I only understood them as my lips pronounced them, would not my life be changed? Words, 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 in my professor's lectures, how much truth remains? If I only understood them as their lips pronounced them, would not my life be changed? Words, 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 in my own papers, how much truth remains? If they only understood them as their lips pronounced them, would not my life be changed? Words, 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 in old songs and stories, how much truth remains? If my mind could understand them, and if my life pronounced them, would not this world be changed? Yes, if my mind could understand them, and if my life pronounced them, would not this world be changed? The reason to do that at the start of the talk was because of the last verse. To a certain extent, it seems to me that knowledge is to change us and to change the world. That's the purpose of it. That's what we do. We don't just do words. We don't just play with words. I think we're playing with things that have wordy aspects, but also should encourage us to do more with them, and I think does in most cases. This is, in a way, a talk about applied ethnomusicology, or what's called applied ethnomusicology. Some of us in this room have talked about it, and we have difficulties with the word applied ethnomusicology, because it seems to imply that there's ethnomusicology, and then there's applied ethnomusicology, which is different and somehow somewhere else. And many of us feel that actually we apply our ethnomusicology every day when we give a class. We apply our ethnomusicology when we perform, and we apply our ethnomusicology right here in the university. You don't necessarily have to apply it outside universities. And there was a tendency to think applied ethnomusicology had to be applied somewhere else. And so anthropology and sociology and our own department, instead of using the word applied ethnomusicology, calls it public ethnomusicology, which implies that you're taking your ethnomusicology and you're doing it for a different public out there rather than only in the university. It doesn't mean you have to only do it out in the public, but it's different. It's not implying that there's a difference between ethnomusicologists who don't apply their knowledge or not. Everybody applies their knowledge. That's what we get it for. Some of us are great teachers. Some of us don't ever want to teach but want to be great archivists. Some of us are... I wouldn't even say what others of us are doing. That's probably better not to. I have had two students at UCLA who decided they didn't want to be professors ever, or at least not in the short term. One was Neva Flohr, Nakisha Nesmith, who decided she really wanted to do applied ethnomusicology out in the communities, in NGOs, and has done that ever since she started writing her dissertation and she finished it. Another one is Kevin Miller, who after getting his PhD decided he wanted to get an MLS or MIS in information sciences and become an archivist, and he's working at Pepperdine University and being an archivist. So there are people who actually take their ethnomusicology, go outside very consciously and very clearly as a life decision. Let's go to the next slide. Here's what the Society for Ethnomusicology Applied Ethnomusicology section says about applied ethnomusicology. The applied ethnomusicology section is devoted to work in ethnomusicology that puts music to use in a variety of contexts, academic and otherwise, including education, cultural policy, conflict resolution, medicine, arts programming, and community music. That's actually, I think that's improved over some of the earlier versions because it actually does say that you can apply it in education, right, at your university as well. The Europeans, when they were looking at the American approach to applied ethnomusicology, noticed that it seemed to be related to the question of jobs. And they thought that actually applying ethnomusicology wasn't a question of jobs for them. It was something else. So let me read, or you can read it too because it's going to come up behind me, the definition of applied ethnomusicology of the study group for applied ethnomusicology of the International Council for Traditional Music. Applied ethnomusicology is the approach guided by principles of social responsibility, which extends the usual academic goal of broadening and deepening knowledge and understanding towards solving concrete problems and toward working both inside and beyond typical academic contexts. The ICTM study group on applied ethnomusicology advocates the use of ethnomusicological knowledge in influencing social interaction and the course of social change. So there's actually an ethical statement about what it is, why it's held, and things like that. It may be a problematic one, but it's there. And I think it comes partly from a number of the applied ethnomusicologists in Europe are actually coming from the former Yugoslavia and coming from terribly divisive and violent wars, and seeing how music was used as a weapon, as part of campaigns to kill people, and wanting to use music for something else, to try to use music to bring people back together again and not kill each other, but to do something else. And so it comes out of an anguished, terribly conflict-ridden situation in Europe, and I think that has shaped to a certain extent their vision of principles of social responsibility. Today but there are jobs in it. I mean, today in anthropology, there are more people who've gotten their PhDs in anthropology who are working outside universities than inside universities. And the entire American Anthropological Association website has been reconfigured to represent the field as something that is actually not really only about studying to become an anthropologist who teaches other anthropologists and does research, but actually being an anthropologist who may work in an NGO, may work in a government agency, and may use their skills and develop new ones, of course, in ways that hadn't been taught in the curriculum, but to which anthropology was particularly applicable and useful. I think that probably will happen in ethnomusicology. It's a little different. The field is a little different. Our skills are different. But I alert you to it, and that's the reason I'm devoting a talk to the topic. That said, I really value universities. Universities are unique institutions. They are places where you can say what you think most of the time. Especially if you're lucky and you're at a good university and you are protected by codes of ethics and codes of the AUP and other things. And I have I've really treasured the times I've been at universities, and I've treasured the position of being at universities, and you'll see a little bit of that in what I'm going to talk about today. At the Smithsonian, it was an extremely hierarchical bureaucracy. Somebody was either your boss or your employee. You had colleagues, but it wasn't the same. It wasn't the same, and it had a tremendous impact on all kinds of other things at the institution. There were places where, in Brazil, you could not say what you thought during the military dictatorship, but universities were one of the places where you most of the time could. I'm going to take the next few minutes to tell you four stories. I was trying to think, I've been thinking for days, how in the world do I talk about applying ethnomusicology and applying anthropology when I've been doing it for 35 years? I mean, it's where do you start? How do you get there? And you've had a whole lot of background. I'm not going to give you background. I'm going to give you stories. I'm going to give you four different things. And they're going to be about sort of the different activities I said I'd talk about. They're going to be about indigenous rights, archiving, record companies, and finally, intangible cultural heritage. Those are the four stories. Each of the stories has some lessons, and it's the lessons that I think are the reason to tell the stories. It's not because I think they're cute stories. I have much more fun stories to tell than these. But these are stories that I think have a point. You tell me. You're welcome to ask about anything else, too. For those of you who are browsing as we're talking, my CV is online, and everything I've written is there, and you can go check out anything and sort of see whether there's something else you'd like to ask about besides the four stories I'm telling you about. First is indigenous rights in Brazil. Thanks. 1975 to 1982. Those were the years when I say I was really an anthropologist. And I was focusing really on anthropology. And I was writing like mad and publishing like mad and working like mad at the National Museum. It was an era of a military dictatorship in Brazil, which had started in 64 or so and was continuing, sort of letting up toward the end of, being forced to let up, I should say, toward the end of the 70s. And that era of the military dictatorship was accompanied by a tremendous amount of development in the interior of the country. The military could control things, and therefore it could open the country for capitalist development. It could encourage foreign loans. Suddenly Brazil seemed like a safe place to put your money because it wasn't going to have a coup, because the people who would do the coup had already done it. And so there was a tremendous amount of power and authority in the military dictatorship, and they basically opened up for business and really moved into the interior. And they opened up the interior in a way that couldn't have been before for a number of reasons. That meant roads were being built, huge hydroelectric projects were being built, and indigenous peoples were in the way of it all. And they were living on lands that were suddenly becoming valuable that hadn't been valuable to anybody much before. That made for an inevitable clash. It made for inevitable continuation of sort of the criminal genocide against indigenous peoples that has been going on for 500 years. It just happened to be the latest chapter at the time of it. And curiously enough, while all this was happening, the government was implementing all kinds of new developments and moving indigenous peoples around and taking them off their lands and allowing them to be killed or poisoned or whatever by default, or not necessarily on purpose, but they just happened to die before anybody got there to help them. The indigenous peoples of Brazil were actually protected by the Brazilian Constitution. Their rights to land were guaranteed in the Brazilian Constitution. So it was the government itself was not obeying its own constitution, which happens a fair amount around the world, and it certainly happens in military dictatorships. And this was happening in Brazil. My applied ethnomusicology, therefore, was actually to work to have Brazil, the rest of all Brazilians, recognize legitimacy of their own constitution with respect to Indians, and then follow what was the constitutionally required actions. The Brazilian government had a particular moment in which it decided it would try to rewrite all of the Indian statutes and declare Indians to be not communities, but indigenous peoples to be not communities, but individuals, give bits and pieces of land to individuals. It was done here in the United States, also sort of scatter them, spread them out, and sort of get rid of the Indian problem by getting rid of the sort of by getting rid of a different kind of autonomous, semi-autonomous regime that they could actually live under. And that provoked the civil society at a moment in Brazil, in the Brazilian military dictatorship, in which it was a little more possible to criticize the government than it had been in previous years. And so those of us who are in indigenous rights suddenly became sort of at the forefront of the criticism of the Brazilian government. You couldn't criticize it because it was imprisoning industrial workers, because that would really get you in jail. You could criticize it on indigenous rights issues, on the other hand, because that was a little more arcane and wasn't really going to threaten the heart of the government's plans for the development of the country. At least they didn't think so. And so comissões pro índio, Indian rights commissions, started in a number of cities. And I, for my sins, was elected president of the Rio de Janeiro Comissão pro índio. Why in the world would you elect a foreigner to head something called the Comissão pro índio in a city that was filled with perfectly good people? I'm never sure why. I went to the meeting. I had my banjo in my hand. I was on my way to see my wife. I was on my way to see my wife where she was doing research. I had to catch a bus because it was an overnight bus to get me to work, attach another bus, and finally get to her field site and see her. And they said, would you allow us to nominate you for president of the Comissão pro índio? And I said, oh, all right, but I don't think I'm a good candidate. Like somebody else. And left. As you know, that's not a good plan. I caught my bus, but I also caught the presidency I was elected probably for several reasons. One is that there were a number of activists who were really much more interested in defeating the military dictatorship or pushing back the dictatorship than they were in the Indian situation. And some of them came from the Maoist line of the Communist Party. Some of them came from the Stalinist line of the Communist Party, should we say. Or perhaps the Marxist side, a different part of Marx's side of the Communist Party. And they preferred to have somebody who was not aligned with either faction running the organization because they thought they could then take it over. In fact, one of my colleagues said, you know, you're just a front man for the Communist Party in this, and as soon as they can figure out how to do it, they're going to get rid of you. And I said, that's okay. I know that, actually. But in the meantime, maybe we can do something about indigenous rights in the country. When they get rid of me, that's okay. This isn't my livelihood. My livelihood is being an anthropologist. But I was there sort of in that position. And I looked at the situation. I said, well, what does an anthropologist bring? Well, an anthropologist brings an analysis of society to an event, to something. And I thought that if I looking around at the indigenous situation in Brazil, which was just filled with conflict, Indians were being shot, they were being killed, land was being invaded, just one case after another all over the country. And it reminded me of all things like the fires in Harlem, New York City. And you say, why are there so many fires in Harlem? It's not just because there are fires in Harlem, it's because of the particular network of sort of landowner avarice, city laws, and the fact that after your apartment is sort of deteriorated to a certain point, you make more money burning it, having somebody burn it down, than you do actually trying to get rent out of it. Seemed to be that there were principles operating behind all these things. They're actually fairly simple and fairly unique, and that somehow the government had to have pressure put on it. Where do you put pressure on military dictatorship? Clearly, it's difficult to do in the streets. One of my great failures as president was we were having a large meeting, a public sort of event, a mass demonstration, so to speak, but inside, and the police declared a bomb threat, and we all had to leave the building. And I didn't know that at that point the president's supposed to say, let's go march on the governor's mansion. So I said, get out of here, let's get safe and leave. And so that's why they should have elected a Brazilian. A Brazilian might have known to say, let's march on the governor's mansion. I didn't. But I did look, and I thought, the weak point in the Brazilian government and the Brazilian economy was that if they didn't get outside money from banks, they were going to strangle. They needed that development money from the World Bank, from the German banks, from a whole lot of banks, and those banks were susceptible to pressure on human rights. Therefore, my job as president of the other should be to go after those banks, should be to somehow figure out how to get to those banks along with other people and try to get them to put stipulations in the loans that actually respected the rights of the indigenous peoples that were there, because they were already, they're already in the Constitution. So it was only, it was all the banks had to do was say, enforce your own constitution in this area. And so that's, that was my job, basically, as president. Other people were leafleting factory workers as they come off their shifts because they wanted to work with factory workers. Other people were writing songs. Other people were holding concerts. I mean, there was a lot going on. But I decided that because of my particular understanding of society, I would apply my energies to banks. Oh, what a great idea. All right. There were a whole lot of really good people also doing applied anthropology projects with indigenous peoples. And they were working with groups that were terribly oppressed, had been sort of thrown off their lands in some cases, or they were working with groups that had terrible health care and they were working in health care. And I looked at what they were doing. I thought it was really interesting, and I thought it was really important that some of them might have been my own students at the National Museum. And those that were my students were students of very good friends and colleagues of mine at other institutions around the country. So it's not as though I really had anything against them, but I really wasn't sure their projects were applied anthropology. They're getting a lot of funding from the Ford Foundation, from other foundations, NGOs, to do applied anthropology projects. And so I decided to have a conference, or I decided to have a session at the National Association of Programs of Postgraduate Study in the Social Sciences, a major organization in Brazil that was getting started in. And I said, let's have a conference, let's have a symposium on how much anthropology is there in the applied anthropology in Brazil. And to do that, I wrote a position paper and sent it to five of the people doing projects around the country with indigenous peoples. And the position paper said basically there wasn't any anthropology in what they were doing. That it was a misnomer to call it applied anthropology, that it was basically very good-intentioned, liberal do-goodism that was certainly benefiting the people there, but wasn't benefiting them at all in the way that it might if they actually used a bit more anthropology. Well, they were all getting their way paid free to the conference, along with 4 days in a hotel and all the food they could eat. So they came, but they were pretty angry. I had a very angry bunch of people when they came. And so we spent 2 days talking about it, and they're presenting their counter-proposals and their counter-papers. And in the end, they pretty much agreed with me that what I was calling anthropology was pretty much absent from their work, and that it might benefit from it. And we all, and I promised never to publish the paper. Next one. Oh, this is the kind of development that was happening in Brazil. You get this. These are fields. Indigenous land starts here. You can tell where the indigenous land is sort of marked there by the fact that that's where the development stops. But if you just get them off, then of course you keep on cutting your fields down all the way across. Next. I'll never tell. I've never published that paper. Because the danger of the paper was that if I had published it and it were taken seriously, the funding agencies probably would have stopped funding it. They couldn't really justify funding applied do-goodism. They were doing it because it was social scientifically appropriate and had some sort of longer-term possibility of success. I said one of the things that was missing, just for an example of what was missing, was any analysis of the local power structures in order to figure out what was going to happen once the people who were there left. It's all very well to have someone from São Paulo come in and start a healthcare system or get the indigenous people working in sort of a community cooperative, but what's going to happen when they leave? What are the structures against that? Where are the structures you might bring to bear to keep it going? Those were the sorts of things they simply weren't looking at. So how much applied ethnomusicology? The lesson from this is my first lessons. Applying a field is more than a label. It really means you need to do some analysis using the tools that you've gotten in the field that you're saying you're applying. And the research has to be really good. It has to be really good. It has to be better than your PhD research, because you can do a whole lot of damage by doing lousy research and then acting on it. If you make a mistake, the implications are far greater than failing your exam or having a bad book review. And so my argument for applying anthropology was it had to be really, really, really good anthropology, and you had to really take not only the anthropology of 20 years ago, you had to be taking the issues facing anthropology today, rethinking the anthropology of 20 or 40 years ago. And I would argue the same for for ethnomusicology. I also thought that it was really good for anthropology to do applied projects. It was really good for anthropologists to be involved in it. I think it's really good for ethnomusicologists to be involved in it. Next slide. I think it's next slide. Oh, yeah, this was some publication I did in the 1970s. Just to, most of my publications in the 70s, many of them were in Portuguese, because I was contributing to the Brazilian intellectual life and not to just the American one. On the other hand, I tried to make sure I published some things in English. I was writing for Cultural Survival, which was an NGO action group. The Anthropology Resource Center was another one. But I was also publishing ethnomusicology. I was writing with my student, Eduardo Rios de Castro, and I was writing some articles that get republished about the structure and performance of Suyakia. Next. Why did I put that one there? Anyway, I hope I... Okay, this is next. It seemed to me that the role of universities, and therefore the role of having that thing at that particular event, was in fact to bring people to reflect in their activities a little bit apart from the activities. And the University of Indiana University for a while had a visiting chair in applied folklore, which brought people and just sort of gave them a 6-month break from whatever they were doing to think and reflect and write about what they've been doing, something that's really very hard when you're doing applied things all the time, from contract to contract. And I had a wonderful fellowship at Ithaca when I was at Cornell University when I was at the Smithsonian, which was 1 week a year. They would pay for me to come to Ithaca and stay in the hotel on campus and just think and write and talk to students and faculty. And that, after just when you're producing recordings all the time and dealing with bureaucracy, was fantastic. And to be able to look ahead another year, it's wonderful to think, oh, only 51 more weeks and I get to go back and spend another week when I can go to the library whenever I want. those are really important moments. And so, you know, as we think about how to do things in the department with respect to the public and applied things, it may be not to hire people who want to leave what they're doing, but actually give them a place in which to contribute what they've done and then go back to the kind of fray that they love and thrive in. Next, archives. Are archives worth the energy that has gone into putting them together? Is what Bruno Nettle asked in 1983. This is the same Bruno Nettle who said that archives were central and fundamental to the founding and development of the field of ethnomusicology 19 years before. And he wrote in 83 in the 29 Issues and Concepts, which is 17 years before the 31 Issues and Concepts that he has written, that sort of came out later, he wrote, "Most archives are of great use to individuals more or less permanently at their institutions. It may amaze readers that few recordings, some in Eastern Europe are clearly exceptions, are fully used by anyone other than the collector. While archives continue to grow, most scholars in their research rely on their own recordings." I may have mentioned this last time. I can't remember. Did I talk much about archiving last time? Because I've been talking about archiving in lots of other contexts in the last 3 weeks, it seems to be. You all come on Saturday. We have the Midwest, we have the Southern California and Hawaii chapter of the Society for Ethnomusicology meeting. You don't have to hear me because I'm saying what I'm going to say to them probably right this second. But come and listen to what other people have to say. I was hired at Indiana University to replace Alan Merriam, who had died in a plane crash when I was taking one of his courses on a postdoc. And I came there in 1982. And as I was coming, the director of the Archives for Traditional Music, Frank Gillis, was retiring. The dean thought of brainstorm and thought, aha, let's do two with one. We'll have Tony Seeger be the director, and he can be Alan Merriam and Frank Gillis all in one. It'll cost half as much. One of those classic dean decisions that happened by just pure happenstance. And I called my colleagues in Indiana. I said, this really seems like a crazy idea. Doesn't it look like you're losing both half a faculty member and half an archivist? And they said, well, it's probably the best shot we've got to have anybody. And so I took the job. And I was told by the chair, who said, look, they're probably going to close the archives. Doesn't really matter to you at all. You've got tenure here in the Department of Anthropology. They close the archives. You just come back to anthropology. We love you here. We want you here. We didn't want them to take you half away anyway. And I thought, uh-oh, that sounds like a pretty good scheme, actually. If you have a new director who you don't have to fire to close the archive, you've got an archive in trouble. And so my first question was, well, should we have an archive at all? It seemed to me that if you're going to fight for something, you have to know why it's worth fighting for, right? And social scientists have this famous thing called a negative hypothesis. If you can prove the opposite of what you think is not true, right? If you can disprove the opposite of what you think, is that anyway? You start with the negative. You start with the opposite of what you're looking for. And so my question was, why shouldn't we close the archive instead of why should we keep it open? Why shouldn't we close the archive? I thought, here's a space. We could use this space for teaching, for dancing, for anything else. Here are a bunch of very qualified people that could be used in the library for things. They could be used in the department for things. There's my time. I could be teaching ethnomusicology and anthropology instead of spending half my time up in an archive pushing papers. Why keep it? And that's what I spent the next 6 months thinking about. And in those 6 months, I was watching what happened in the archive, who came and used it. Bruno Nettel was right. Very few people from the university used it. Very few students came except for when they were assigned to come. Very few people from outside the university that were scholars came because they were going to make their own recordings. Other people kept coming. Some of them were folklorists coming to get new songs. Some of them were grandchildren of people who'd been recorded in Elk Bone, Indiana, or wherever I think it's called, and coming to hear their grandparents, and it really was a big deal for them. And then we got this letter from the Fox Indians who wrote and said that they knew that sometimes someone had recorded one of their ceremonies. They'd forgotten the songs. If we were the place, could we make them a copy of the songs? But they didn't know if we had them. And our catalog wouldn't be available online anyways at the time, so there was no online for us. And we did actually have them. And they were so happy to get them. And they used them, actually, in a creative way. They said, we're actually using them. And I looked at that, and I looked at the people, the grandchildren, and I thought, yeah, this is interesting. And then I read Karl Marx, which I've told you about several times. But the American Library Association has asked me not to mention Karl Marx in my papers when I'm talking about archiving. And so I'm going to mention it to you. I mean, you have to do something in a university that you can't do somewhere else. So Karl Marx, I was reading the 18th Premier of Louis Bonaparte, and on the second paragraph, he says, the past weighs like a nightmare on the minds of the living. And just when they're about to change themselves in true and fundamental ways, they take up the old battle cries of the past, put on the garments of ancient times, and don't change. And he thought that was terrible. He thought that was what really undermined and ruined, as it made inoperable, the revolution of 1848. He said it was people suddenly sort of taking on the past and using the past and misusing the past. He said that Hegel was right about history repeating itself, but he neglected to say that the second time it repeats itself is farce. First time it may be tragedy, the second time is farce, and the farce was 1848. So he was really angry couple of paragraphs. It's one of the greatest pieces of writing, I think, that you can read for getting an idea of the passion of the social sciences and the social philosophers of the 19th century. It's a very passionate piece. I looked at it and I said, yeah, he's right. When people are in the process of changing themselves, they look to the past, and they're trying to create a future out of that past. Therefore, the past is important. Therefore, what archives have is in fact the tools with which people are going to build their future. Therefore, if we aren't careful with them, they're not going to have those tools. Therefore, I'm going to become an archivist. I'm not going to become an archivist. I'm going to become a passionate advocate for archiving, for preservation, and for dissemination. Right? That was my moment. I came out of the 6 months. That was it for the next however many years it's been, 25 or something like that. And it really, I owe it to watching. I went to research. What do you have as a scholar? I knew how to do research. I knew how to ask questions. I knew how to watch. I knew it took time. So I didn't go in with a full-blown plan on my first day of what I was going to do to the archives and to the archives, probably, poor guys. It was really, I wanted to figure out what was going on and whether it was worthwhile. Then, much to my surprise, across my desk came a memo from Herman B. Wells, I think it was, the chancellor, former chancellor of Indiana University, the person who really built the university into what it is today. And he had been a classmate of a composer named Hoagy Carmichael. Hoagy Carmichael wrote Georgia on My Mind and a whole bunch of other songs. He'd appeared in films. And he was a native son of Bloomington, Indiana. And the letter from, and the email, it wasn't an email, it was a memo from Chancellor Wells said, a family of Hoagy Carmichael wants to donate some of his things to the university. Is there anybody who's interested in taking on Hoagy Carmichael's things? I'm an anthropologist. I know about symbols. I know about the significance of place. I'm going to take that collection. So I wrote Herman Wells back the same day, and I said, I've got this vision of this collection. I think it'd be great. The Archives of Traditional Music is exactly the place for it. We've got thousands of jazz records. We've got his records right here. Here's what we need. We need a new space. I want a room devoted to Hoagy Carmichael's things with his things in it, and I want a jukebox playing his music, and I also want to completely change the archives because we can't really, there's no room for it here besides it's an embarrassing place for the family to have their stuff. That jumped the request for space from the continual bottom of the heap as the science has kept on needing more lab space and everybody else needed more space, right to the top because of Chancellor Wells' interest and because of Hoagy Carmichael's power as a symbol for the state of Indiana, for the university. And lo and behold, we were able to move the archives to Morrison Hall. Nice new space with a Hoagy Carmichael room in it. And I was able to get a decorator that had nothing to do with any of the decorators on the university to decorate it. I mean, this was a big deal because the university decorators are so bland. So we got this space and it had this... Anyway, it was... Don't ever forget that you're scholars, that you know about this stuff. I knew about symbols. I mean, I spent my life working with Victor Turner until then. I knew. This was applied anthropology. Or better yet, applied ethnomusicology, since it was really about music. So you can apply your ethnomusicology. You have to think consciously about what is it that ethnomusicology is? What is it that we know? What is it that we can do? Well, we can ask questions. We recognize the importance of symbols. We recognize the importance of rituals. We recognize that at certain moments, power coalesces through music, and you just have to find the right people and the right power. Chancellor Wells was amazing. He sort of gave $100 a year to the archive, to our friends, and he also came to concerts that we would give in the Hoagy Carmichael room afterwards. He was fairly elderly. He came to one on May Day, in which we did union songs. He was actually a great stand-up defenser of unions in the state of Indiana, which is not a terribly popular position now, but it is important to recognize the universities at one time have stood up for the power of unions in their states. So the lessons there. You need to evaluate what you're being asked to do. Sometimes you may be asked to take on something you really can't believe in. You really just would have to say, I can't think of any reason that, from an ethnomusicologist's point of view, that this should even exist. I can't think of why I should devote 1 minute to this project. And then you have to not devote your time to it. You have to figure out how to convince somebody else to devote their time to it, which is one good solution. I'm looking at some people and I've done that too. Or you have to just get out of the way and go do what it is you're good at. The other thing is, you really need to use your own skills to decide what you can do with something. And when a high-profile opportunity comes along, don't pass it up. I mean, Archives of Traditional Music was really about field collections done by scholars, but I certainly wasn't about to pass up Hoagy Carmichael. And we had Hoagy Carmichael shirts. You know, this Hoagy Carmichael never be all over the place, and it's great. Hoagy Carmichael, music moves a lot of different people in a lot of different ways. That particular one was great for Indiana and for the archive. Research is what we do. If you do research, it seems to me you can do it on your application of ideas, and publish. Let's see what comes up next. This is what Charles Seeger said about applied musicology. Charles said in 1937, he said, without an applied musicology, the pure study of music must of necessity know less well where it stands, where it's going, where its weak links are, what motivations lies behind it, and what ends it serves. Charles was in 1937, he'd been applying ethnomusicology himself, but one of the nice things about Charles is he actually wrote about what he was doing and wrote about it in a general way. And that's what I've tried to emulate in my own career. So when I've written about archives, I haven't been writing about how difficult it was to do a particular collection in a particular place, but the implications of that challenge, which maybe comes next. Yeah, archives and articles on archiving, the role of sound archives in ethnomusicology, ethnographic anomalies and technical puzzles in the reproduction of wax cylinder recordings. I bet you never thought I'd written about that. That was written with 3 graduate students who were helping me transcribe wax cylinders and delivered in Japan and published. And then the other one is the collection, preservation, and archiving of field recorded materials in a publication in India, and that's where Dan and I crossed paths, I think, not for the first time, because we run into each other at meetings, but that's where we crossed paths in the archival line. And next. singing other people's songs. Archives are also about intellectual property rights, and that was my first piece on intellectual property rights, 1991, 20 years ago, 22, 21 years ago. Ethnomusicology and Music Law came out not that long after it. Ethnomusicology's Archives and Professional Organizations and the Shifting Ethics of Intellectual Property came out not that long after that, and you can sort of see where I've been going since then. Let's see. Smithsonian Folkways Recordings. Next one. The next to last story here, and it's probably the shorter. No, it's about the same, but it's the last one short because I don't have much to say about it yet. I haven't figured out what I'm saying. Smithsonian Folkways Recordings was a clear case of family recognition. They wanted me there. Ralph Rinzer wanted me there because my name was Seeger. I had connections with a whole lot of the live artists on Folkways. The Seeger family had probably around 200 different albums on Folkways already, so that the family was deeply involved in the Folkways record label. I'd met Ralph when I was 9 years old, and he was on the back of my Aunt Peggy's motor scooter doing a tour of Vermont. And he recruited me like a fisherman. He tried to hook me, and then he just sort of played me for months. He would invite me to his house just to visit. I went to several meetings about what to do about Folkways because I was an archivist and I was running the archives. And he got my Uncle Mike to come up to me and say, you know, Tony, the family would really, really think you do a good job on this. We really think you should take over the directorship of Folkways. That was when I thought, oh, my God, it's the mafia. The Seeger family is the mafia. I'd suddenly been told it's the family. It actually had a pretty big impact. Because when I was told, you know, when Mike thought, basically it was Mike's thing, he thought, but he was also implying that the family was probably thinking that. But, well, you know, I do have certain skills in this particular area that practically nobody else applying for this job would have. I know a whole lot of the artists by name. I know a whole lot of the artists by history. I grew up in New York City in exactly the same year that Moses Ash was working in. I had the same radical sort of left background that a whole bunch of the people involved in the label did. And so I thought, well, shoot, I'll do it. And so I gave back the grants I had for 2 years, and I left Indiana University and went to Smithsonian. And then kicked myself around the block for having made a terrible mistake for a few years. The job description they wrote was totally legal, but so complicated and filled with clauses that I didn't think anybody else could fill it, and in fact, they couldn't. I mean, it was one of those cases where just watch those things that come along in federal applications. Just look, the more complicated they are, the more possible it is that they have someone in mind. Not always. Ralph did it. You know, Ralph got me in. He gave me total authority. I was the only person who was both a curator, scholar, and a director who could handle money in the whole institution, as far as I know. So I was allowed to deal with monetary decisions that were mostly, in other cases, relegated to people who actually knew about money and didn't have any scholarship at all. They were money managers. And so he gave me a particular position in that institution that was amazing. And it was an amazing amount of autonomy. And he said, you can do anything you want, just don't lose money. And that was how I did it. Now, I wrote about this too, and so some of those articles up there were about the implications of Folkways, because a record company is basically a set of rights and obligations. My anthropology prepared me perfectly for running a record company. British social anthropology focuses on rights and obligations. It focuses on social organization as a bundle of rights. You couldn't get any better. I mean, my whole training by Victor Turner, my whole reading of Max Fluckman and Evans Pritchard and all those people who were talking about, they were talking about rights and obligations. They were talking about systems of rights and obligations, and that is what a record company is. It's not much else. I mean, you may think it's about beautiful music, but it's really about who has the rights to use what parts of that music in what ways and for what kind of money. And so I figured out record companies. I did the same sort of research. I got on the road. I visited a whole lot of record companies, asked a whole lot of questions. That's what we know how to do. We know how to talk, right? Ethnomusicologists know how to do interviews. That's what we do. We do it all the time, and we're good at it. You should be good at it by the time you get your PhD. You should have done it a lot. Well, I basically did the same thing. Kept notes, have a journal of my field trips, and came back and said, this is how we're going to do it. And no one got in my way. Amazingly, no one got in my way. So that's how I got to be head of Folkways. And then I was really lucky here. Some things just happened. The CD came along. Folkways was an LP label. It had, when I took over, I think like 85,000 LPs in a warehouse that couldn't be sold. And the CD was just starting. It didn't have a single CD. It only had about 10 cassettes. And so it was totally obsolete. And yet the great thing was, with the CD, people would buy the same record twice. They'd already bought it on an LP, they'd buy it again on a CD. And all I had to do to actually make enough money to keep Folkways, to advance Folkways, pay for the archiving, and sort of develop the whole project was sell people the stuff they already owned and loved. And that's what I did for the next 10 years or so, until the CD, of course, began to look not quite so great. But for that period, a whole lot I was able to do in terms of producing really interesting recordings of for ethnomusicologists and producing really important, some really important things, something I'm really proud of having made available to people, was partly based on an accident of timing. And it was partly based on the power of the two words Smithsonian and Folkways. And it was partly based on an impossible urge to promote that I have. My license plate was Folkways. My t-shirts were always Folkways t-shirts. I had a bumper sticker that I gave to people, "You can hear the world on Folkways." I had another one that I sent to artists saying, "You can hear me on Folkways." I figured that the number of people that look at your license and your bumper stickers as you're driving is immensely more for the price than that looks at an ad in a paper or something like that. So I became sort of a personal, I became an advocate. So you have to really love it. You have to love sales. And I happen to love sales. My great-grandfather, Charles Ludwig, or whatever, Charles, you know, that I talked about in 1860, loved sales too, it turns out. I told my father one, he said, "You know, son, you're about to get married. I can't support you anymore. You know, you're on your own with your wife." And I said, "It's okay. I think I can make this graduate school pay for itself." And I said, "If I'm wrong, I'm going to quit the whole thing and go to business school." And he said, "Fine." And that was my backup plan, was to go to business, Harvard Business School. And fortunately for all of us, the first plan worked out. But the second plan happened. I mean, then I went and ran a record company. The lessons, though, is what happened when the internet came along? You know about the crisis that the so-called record industry has entered because of the internet. And yet my vision of it was really very different. I was always an early adapter and reader of magazines on computers, though I'm totally incompetent about actually using them. I have an idea of what could be done with them if I ever had the time to learn it. And the biggest challenge for independent record labels then, and still the biggest challenge for most of them today, and the biggest challenge for independent artists, was distribution, was getting your material to people who would like it. It was easy to make a recording. It was really hard to get it out to people. And in the 1980s, and 90s, the way you got most of your things out was through record stores, something that most of you have perhaps never seen, or some of you have never seen. But how to get it in record stores? Record stores make their living selling copies of things. If they can't sell something, it sits there, they're losing money, and they're losing money by the portion of a square foot. And so they don't like to have things they can't sell. Folkways had a challenge. It had 2,200 different titles, at least 25% of which had not sold a single copy in the last 4 years when I took it over. So that meant that, you know, 500 records, hadn't sold, 600 records, hadn't sold a thing, hadn't sold a single copy. And so how do you get the store to take on that? It's going to sit in your store for 4 years and you're not going to sell a single, they wouldn't. I couldn't get the Folkways company catalog into stores. I get selected items into stores. 5% of the label provided 80% of the sales. Half of the sales were for music for children. So you may think of it as sort of an ethnomusicology label. Well, it may have been an ethnomusicology label, and it published recordings submitted by a whole lot of ethnomusicologists, but it was not making its money. That was making its money on children's music. It's still making its money on children's music, partly on the back of the same wonderful artist, Ella Jenkins, who has sort of indomitably continued performing into her 80s, but partly because of a whole bunch of new artists that we've been getting over the years, too. Children's music supported it. It then... The label then, the director Moses Ash, and I then used that money to do all kinds of other stuff that we thought was also important. But we couldn't get into the stores. So it seemed to me that the internet was going to be a perfect solution, because that way everything would be made available to people right in front of them. The other problem we had with sales was if we wanted to ship things overseas, there were duties on every overseas shipment, there were very expensive shipping charges, and we had a bunch of sort of not very efficient overseas distributors. We did our best to improve our relations with them, but they weren't selling enough to really get terribly enthusiastic over the sales. So the internet was basically a way that we could sell internationally immediately everything. And it just seemed like absolutely perfect. It seemed like the way to go. I was in favor of the internet from the instant it came along, and I had a plan, which we called Global Sound, which was to get a whole bunch of different archives together to put parts of their collections online through a Smithsonian portal that would allow you to that would allow the archives to put parts of their collections on. But it would also allow you to pay to download it or to license it, pay thousands of dollars to license it for your feature film, because it would all be cleared. Yes?
Roughly what year are you talking about?
This was 1980s. This was what, 1990s, late 90s. And so we started this. We raised a fair amount of money for it. It didn't work the way we planned, partly because, of course, the internet music was a moving target through that whole period. And so the vision we had when we started was not what we could actually do at the end, because the whole thing had changed a number of ways. It was the bleeding edge of technology. But the idea was that, let's say it was $1 for every download to make life simple in your head. 50 cents of that would go to the archive, and they would give half of the money they got directly to the artists. So my thought was, this was a way, the vision of the whole thing was that certain kinds of traditional arts are disappearing in lots of places, partly because the artists can't make a living. Since they can't make a living at it, they don't have anybody wanting to study with them, because they wouldn't make a living. If you can, in fact, find a way to get traditional artists so they actually benefit from the art that they're making through this kind of repass, then you're benefiting not just the artist, but possibly an art, and certainly changing a set of hierarchical relationships that have not benefited those local artists in the past. So that was them. And then the other problem was archives. Archives throughout the world are struggling for funds. They never have enough money. They never have enough space. They never have much prestige in the institution they're in. If half the money of what they were receiving actually went to the archives itself, it would benefit the archives. It would actually give them not just money, but also, as in the case of the artist, the symbolic prestige of getting it from someplace else of high renown, like the Smithsonian, or more or less at the time, you know, high renown, in the sense that it's not coming from your friend, the donor, who has an extra $1,000, but actually it's coming from an institution with which you have a structural relationship that will last over time. So the idea of the whole project was both a local artist and arts stimulation project, or preservation project, you might call it, or whatever, a safeguarding project, and also an archive safeguarding project, and the other 50% was going to go to get more archives involved and keep the website going. Turned out that the money didn't quite work that way because other intermediaries were in the way. But the idea, I'm convinced, was an interesting applied ethnomusicology idea. I mean, there was ethnomusicology applied right out there. It was an application of what I thought was the problem for many individual struggling artists that I'd seen over the years. It was an application of what I thought was the problem for many archives I'd visited to and traveled to and was on the advisory boards of, or Professor Rossi and I were on a meeting or two in Khartoum about the archive there, and so we know about the struggle that archives have everywhere, and so I was fully embracing the internet, still do, and you can actually get Global Sound on through the university, which subscribes to it, and you can listen to every single song streamed, not only from Smithsonian Folkways, but also from the other two partner institutions that we were able to complete the work with. Before we basically ran out of money. Turns out archives aren't the best place to get music when you're looking for it, because they don't have clearances for most of it. And secondly, they often don't have photographs to go with it, and sometimes their documentation about what it's really all about isn't so good either. So I was, at the same time, acquiring record companies. So my other kind of collection I was acquiring for the Smithsonian was record companies. So I convinced people to donate a number of different independent record companies, because I think independent record labels have been in the United States some of the most interesting and creative sort of growing edges of music in the country, and I wanted them to have a chance to be preserved, not just the big labels like Sony. And I joked, someday we'll acquire Sony, and it might happen, you know, one of the days they're going to have to give all their tapes to the Smithsonian for preservation. For the Library of Congress. Compare that with a major label. The major labels had a very different view of the internet when they saw it coming along. For one thing, they owned a distribution system and could basically ensure that any record they wanted to have in a record store would get there. They could force any recording they wanted down the throats of the record store by simply saying, if you don't take this, we won't sell you Michael Jackson or something like that. And if you don't pay on time, we're never going to give you another whatever it is you're selling. So they had immense power. Immense power. It's really difficult to conceive, if you haven't actually been there, how different the situation was of a small independent label from a major label that owned this distribution. They could ensure that it would be carried. They had a sales force that would go out and convince people that they should carry it. And they had warehouses in which they could store it. And they had a profit line to protect when they saw the internet coming and saw, whoops, there might be a moment in which we won't be moving physical product anymore and we can't actually control what goes in front of people's eyes. That was a threat. I mean, that was a clear threat to their profits. They also owned other things. They owned pressing plants. They owned plants where you used to press CDs in the old days and then where you pressed CDs today. I mean, the CDs, the ones you burn on your computer are one thing, but actually the ones that are manufactured aren't burned. Usually they're actually made in different manufacturing process that looks like pressing. They had a huge investment in land, in factories, in trained people, in staff that they would have to pay to let go. They had every reason, again, to be terrified. The record industry as it was directly threatened, but the independent labels weren't because we didn't own any of those things. We didn't have that kind of power to get into the stores in the first place. So it really didn't bother us at all. Record stores go out of business. It's been hard on Folkways and others, but the situation was different. And the lessons here, they had a lot to lose, and they have lost a lot, and they've been very resentful. And I was always sort of amused at how quickly companies that thought that there should be laissez-faire business in this country suddenly went running to the federal government asking for protection when their particular business got in trouble. It's all very well to think, gee, no, capitalism is great, get out of our way, we're just going to do whatever we want until suddenly you can't do it anymore for some reason or another, having to do with changing market systems or changing tastes, and suddenly you want to protect it. We aren't free of that problem ourselves, but certainly that was very evident in their case. So the lessons. Well, something comes along, you have to see what it does for you, not what it does for everybody else. I mean, I didn't pay a bit of attention when I was reading a billboard about what the internet might do to the music industry. It seemed to me that was really what it was doing to me. And you have to do an analysis of, you get back to your research again. Researchers, we ask questions, we talk to people. That's what's how I faced it. You create a plan. You try to raise money so that somebody else's money that you're losing if you don't quite get done what you'd hope to do. Of course, everybody's doing that, but it works also for us. It works for major companies like people who are selling bad mortgages, but it also works for us with the Rockefeller Foundation to give us a lot of money to do Global Sound. Global Sound, money from this operation that you can listen to here at the library, for which the University of California pays maybe $10,000 a year. All of those subscriptions together is about one-third of Smithsonian Folkways' income today. So Smithsonian Folkways is doing remarkably well in the digital age, partly because of its subscription base to its very large and growing all the time collection. Let's see. So that's the Smithsonian case. Had to do with luck, had to do with rights, had to do with seeing how things work and then trying to be somewhere else as quickly as possible. And in the case of this, it was in the digital domain. And the last story. Last story is about you. What is it called? ICH. Does anybody know what ICH is?
Intangible cultural heritage.
Burn it into your brain. Intangible cultural heritage. You'll see it all the time. What we used to call music is intangible cultural heritage. What you used to call myths are intangible cultural heritage. What you used to think you did when you remembered a recipe and made a cookie is intangible cultural heritage. And it is an issue of great concern to many people around the world because they think that they might lose it. My exposure to intangible cultural heritage came through another whole part of my applied ethnomusicology, which was my activities in professional organizations. And through my career, I've been active in a number of them. There's a slide there, but I quit my slides. I left it with a sunset. I did a lot of them. One of the things that happened to come along was I was president of the International Council for Traditional Music, which is an international organization affiliated with UNESCO. UNESCO's in Paris. As president, I would go regularly to the meetings in Paris. of the other NGOs, and since I was also for a time head of the ICTM UNESCO record label, I was also going for overseeing the production of recordings and things like that. Well, the United States was not part of UNESCO at the time. It was a little awkward being an American there. It was like being an American in a country that just had a revolution against the United States or something. I felt sort of odd being an American. On the other hand, I had to realize that for them, I wasn't just an American, I was also president of the International Council of Traditional Music, which is an official organization which does have a place in UNESCO. And so I just put my jacket on and applied it. And one of the things that they were working on was something called the Masterpieces of the Intangible Cultural Heritage, or Oral and Intangible Heritage of Humanity. And we got it so that the International Council for Traditional Music was doing the technical and scientific analysis of the proposals for it, which were about half or more of the nominations. And so suddenly, you know, those of you who were with me here in those years, it was taking an immense amount of my time to get these boxes and boxes of stuff and then find people who would review proposals to create, to proclaim a certain kind of oral traditional cultural heritage as a masterpiece. And the reason to do that was well, there were a number of reasons to do that. And I won't go into that because that's a really long story. But that was my involvement. And so I became deeply involved. I would then go and sit in on the decision-making process by which an international jury of recognized eminent people would decide whether or not something was, in fact, a masterpiece and should be proclaimed or not, based on, among other things, our technical review possibly of other or associations, and their own readings of the files, which had to be, by definition, very quick because they were in Paris only for a few days. And they were very eminent people. Professor Anquetil was there. Olive Lewin was there. Members of our own International Council for Traditional Music and SEM were certainly part of this. Richard Curran was there, but so was a princess from... Cambodia. What would I say?
Kapucha?
Probably. So a princess, I believe, from Southeast Asia somewhere. And so there were also royalty, and there were great writers. And so it was a really unusual group of people, and these were the jury. It was my lesson in, one of my lessons in UNESCO. So I became involved in this, and then I also became involved in the next step, which was UNESCO was trying to create a new convention for the safeguarding of the intangible cultural heritage of the world. And the way they went about starting that convention was they began to have regional meetings in different parts of the world to create a movement of resolution saying there should be a new convention, that what existed in UNESCO wasn't enough, there should be something new. And Madame Aikawa, who was the head of the Intangible Heritage Division at the time, recruited me to go to one meeting in Ghana, in which we all met and we solemnly agreed that actually there should be something more adequate than there was in sort of the Statement on Folklore in 1984. And then I went to Lebanon. We did the same thing. I couldn't go to a couple of others because I was, in fact, trying to run a record company. But the upshot was we had a meeting. Then I held the global meeting in Washington, D.C. It was the only time, you know, the United States still wasn't a member of UNESCO. Smithsonian was the place that the UNESCO thought would be the sort of logical interlocutor. But to hold a UNESCO meeting in the United States was a very interesting challenge for the Foreign Office of various places, for UNESCO and for the Smithsonian, but we had a very good time. And we came up with a declaration saying, yes, we need a new declaration that represents the current ideas about heritage, about the importance of traditional knowledge, about protecting people's traditional knowledge. And lo and behold, it became the 2003 Declaration on Convention. It was a convention, so it's actually signed like a treaty, in a sense. The countries that sign it, and enough have signed it, actually are required to do things by that convention. They're required to set up a whole system for surveying and evaluating the intangible cultural heritage of the country, and to set up ways to promote it, safeguard it, and things like that. This was a really interesting process. I think it's an interesting process partly because here's an area where our ethnomusicology sort of thrives. I'm supposed to be giving a talk in 2 weeks and one day on, is it possible to safeguard intangible cultural heritage? And if it is, should we? I haven't got an answer yet. Give me 2 weeks and one day. But the issue is, I think on the basis of everything that ethnomusicologists know about music is it changes course it changes. And it is what it is in part because of politics and economics and people's ideas about aesthetics and a whole bunch of things. Therefore, the idea that you can just sort of safeguard it is a really complicated one. And the whole way that the convention was created involved ethnomusicologists such as Wim van Zanten and Christer Malm was a Patience of a Saint, and others sitting in meetings in Europe just sort of debating day after day after day over words, single words. Because the word traditional is complicated. The word authentic is enough to kill you, right? And so they were debating these words, and they finally came up with a convention, and then it was turned over to the diplomats who came in and said, no, we like the word authentic. You guys used to use the word authentic. Here, I quote you. They found quotes. The meetings were filled with pointing out our own inconsistencies as scholars, and yet our own inconsistent selves knew that there was going to be a problem with this. There are problems with it, but it's a very interesting thing to study and think about, and it has brought attention to intent. It brought attention to music, knowledge, local knowledge, especially to governments' minds in a way never before. It was never before present, and in certain countries, it has shaped a cadre of trained ethnomusicologists and anthropologists who work for ministries of culture, who try to figure out how to safeguard it and do something with it. And so it's actually a great employer of our colleagues in Brazil and Colombia and Bolivia and probably a whole bunch of other countries, Guatemala perhaps, and other countries I'm not aware of. So here's applied ethnomusicology run amok to a certain extent. It's applying ethnomusicology that we might not want to apply, but it's working away. It's a very interesting process. I haven't got an answer, but it seems to me that here's a case where, again, what do you do? You sit down and you look at these things and you say, well, how does an ethnomusicologist evaluate this kind of thing? You do research, you talk to people, look at cases, you try to get a whole bunch of people together looking at different cases, try to bring them together, talk about it. You can make a statement, you can give a talk like the one I'm giving in Hawaii, which is basically sort of a provocation, and see what comes up in the discussion. And I think that's what we do. That's applying ethnomusicology. That's our job. That's one of our many jobs. Our other jobs is good, interesting courses and perform music if we're performers and create programs, protect the existence and sort of autonomy of universities and things like that. We all have to do all those things too. But one of our jobs as ethnomusicologists is to think about these things that the rest of the world is doing with ideas that come from our discipline, have been changed and altered and need to be rethought, need to be reworked, and perhaps we can come up with proposals that will work better than what's been worked, will actually advance our field as a way of thinking. Ideas forged in the crucible of conflict with nation states about whatever intangible cultural heritage is, and will actually make us think better about it. So the lesson sort of from all of this that I wanted to bring to the end of this talk was I think it's good for ethnomusicology to be challenged by looking outside itself. I think it's not a half bad thing to actually get outside your offices and get outside your comfort zone and actually be recruited to do things that you never really thought you ever wanted to do, like be president of Indian Rights Commission. That was not in my plan. Director of a record company, sort of neat idea, but never in my plan. My plan was, and coming here, I had a real plan when I came here, and I couldn't do it because I suddenly was drafted to be Secretary General of the ICTM, which led me to this fascinating thing with UNESCO, but left a couple of books in the dust. So, is it worth it? Do you do it? What do you do? What do we do outside? What's it all for? Yeah, what's it all for? Well, I think it's partly for making your career coherent with a set of values that you have discovered through your readings, through your families, and through your life. Thank you very much. There's a little bit of time for some questions for those of you who can stand it. Is this room hot? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
This room is the window's not open very well.
What does your t-shirt say?
Oh, my t-shirt! Oh, the t-shirt has changed. Ah, the t-shirt. I had to think about this t-shirt, and then I just decided, well, it was a black t-shirt, it would work better with my red shirt than the other one sitting in the drawer.
Oh, no.
analog. It's not only because it sounds good, but because if it doesn't last long enough, we're not going to have had a chance to transfer it to digital before it's gone. And this shirt was sold at the Association of Recorded Sound Collections meeting, but on the back is its sponsor, Cover Your Assets, LTO Tape. LTO is a digital tape, and they were saying, we love analog because you'll buy our tapes to put it on digital formats with. And so they were right. But I do love analog, and archives really need to love analog because we have an awful lot of it to transfer. That's my applied ethnomusicology shirt for the day. Yes?
May I ask a question? Has there been any analysis of the results after giving the commendations of intangible cultural heritage to any of the projects that have been reviewed and granted this?
We're increasingly getting reports of what's happened to artists and art forms that have been declared intangible cultural heritage. We don't have them everywhere. I proposed to UNESCO that they actually allow the ICTM to send the same people who had evaluated the projects in on the ground to see what the implications were, because they were the ones who had sort of seen the project. They could actually, they were outside the system. They could evaluate it differently, certainly, than the people from the Ministry of Culture of the country itself evaluated. But they did say they didn't have the money and weren't going to do it. So we don't really have the kind of, we don't have enough of the independent information that I like to have by people who aren't, who don't have a vested interest in it. So the answer is yes, it's beginning to come in. Some of it looks good, some of it doesn't. And I wrote an article I came to UCLA to go to a conference, and somehow I was convinced to apply for a job here in 1999. And some of the people who were involved in that are also in this room. And I gave a paper on why the Suyad like to listen to música sertaneja. They don't sing it, right? So, you know, sort of play, and why Suyad sing, why they like to listen to it. And basically I was arguing that there are reasons why they might like to, and there are reasons why they might not, and I wasn't sure exactly how it was going to play out, but these were the things involved, and I sort of put out a number of things. I think that's sort of what's happening in intangible cultural heritage. Some things may be good for some people, some things are terrible for other people, some things are sort of governments take on, sort of suddenly become authoritarian about an art form and want to try to freeze it, make it authentic, or they want to make it into a tourist event. And the thing about music is it's going to be affected by things anyway. Music is always affected by things. So when a tourism grows up, it's going to affect musicians. When governments make new policies, it's going to affect musicians. I have a whole different set of ideas about why certain traditions are killed or die. Or, you know, they don't die, they're killed, in a sense. They disappear for a reason. They're disappeared. And there's certain things that I think regularly happen around the world that make them vulnerable to disappearance. That doesn't mean that we should necessarily go around and change them all and save them all, but it does mean I think we can look actually at some of these processes in a more abstract way, getting away from particular individualities and particular recriminations about certain ministries of culture and certain individuals. So I think there's room there for us to do some really interesting theoretical work. I just hope you do some of it.
You recommend this then as a dissertation topic for an ethnomusicologist to?
I think there are a number being written on it, actually. A couple of master's theses in Brazil, on the Brazilian one. There are probably some in other places, but it certainly would be an interesting topic for an American to write about. I mean, we do have a different perspective on things. I might add that the United States has a very bad relationship with the UNESCO, he says. Yes.
Were you involved in the appointment of your successor at Smithsonian Folkways, and what kind of concerns and results occurred about maintaining your vision of the organization?
All right, here's what happened. It seemed to me I had to leave the Smithsonian for a number of reasons. One, I was tired of doing the bureaucracy. Two, I really liked teaching, and I wanted to get back to the classroom. The third is I had a real concern that if somebody stays in the job too long, it becomes too closely identified with them, and they get what's called founder syndrome. They die with the founder. They die with the person who did it. Now, I wasn't the founder of it, but I certainly was the founder of it as it was at the Smithsonian. So I thought I really had to get out for a number of reasons that happened to coincide nicely. But I wasn't. I was chair of the committee that actually sought my successor, and the committee chose eventually Dan Sheehy, who has a PhD from here. He's done a great job. In my last year, he was appointed, but then had a year. I was giving people lots of time to get used to my leaving, and also I delayed coming, things like that. Did it as early as I could. So in the last year, I put out as many music of protest and struggle reissues as I possibly could, and new projects as I could. I thought, this is something no one else is going to care about as much as I am. My God, this year, this is the year for it. So if you look at, I think it's 1999 and 2000, you'll see a rather remarkable number of songs of protest and struggle coming out in that year, because I figured, well, this is my contribution. And he's come in and done an amazing job with, especially with Latin music and some other really neat projects they're doing. They have a great Woody Guthrie book coming out now, and he's managed to put the label in all kinds of places in the Smithsonian. It's really impressive. And so I've been extremely happy, and I think I was extremely fortunate. We're going to come up against another transition one of these days. And the Smithsonian, those of us who grew up in the 60s, and those of us who sort of came out of a period of repression and vision, of, we think we had vision, and we think we had ideals about what we thought things should be like, are all retiring. And the question is, will the people who were born 20 years, 30 years later, where are their ideals, and how are they going to express them? Where are they going to be? And we're all concerned about that in every place that I work. I mean, I work here, I work at Smithsonian part-time, I'm director emeritus of Folkways. You know, I'm concerned there, too. And I don't know, guys, you got to get up there. Get out there. I wasn't so old when I started this stuff. I was, in my day, there weren't very many older ethnomusicologists. There weren't as many older ethnomusicologists when Dan and I got started. You know, so suddenly we had to take responsibility really young, because there wasn't an older generation, even more in Brazil, where there wasn't an older generation. That hadn't been exiled or died or left the field of combat. So I was sort of pushed into this earlier than I was ready. But come on, guys, come along, hurry up, get your dissertations written, and take over. Yes.
My question is, well, just an observation, is that you've written a lot of stuff. You're quite prolific during all of these times of your doing your applied whatever, and can you just share some insight into the process of writing as you're doing all of these things? Like, how did you make the time to do that, and how did you conceive of it in relation to the work that you were doing?
Well, first of all, I think that we as scholars need to write in many different ways. We need to write for the public in one way, we need to write for our friends, scholars, in another way, and we should be doing them all at once. I was freed from tenure decision. No one was checking me for tenure, because I said last time I got it just by living 90 days in Brazil without being proven ignorant, or, you know, I'll be proven totally mad. I mean, I had to be totally mad to lose my job in Brazil in 90 days, and after that, I don't think I had a choice. So, and I had an amazing schedule in Brazil. I was teaching one seminar a semester, met 3 hours a week. That meant I had every single other day an hour to do whatever I felt was appropriate. That was an amazing amount of time. Very few American scholars get that. And so that was 7 years there. Then I came back to the United States and got half-time teaching and half-time running the archive. And that gave me up again to write, because running the archive was basically just making, just sort of getting things in, doing new contracts, supervising a whole lot of stuff. That freed me up. Then when I went to Smithsonian, that was hard. Smithsonian, I didn't get much written in those years. But I produced 250 CDs, so my fingerprints are all over those CDs. I rewrote a whole bunch of liner notes and produced a bunch of stuff, and T-shirts and all kinds of things came through me. So everything flows. Fun thing about being a director of a really small thing is you do everything, or you get other people to do it, so it's really fun. So I approved really crazy things because people came up with crazy ideas. Then when I came here, you should know, I asked for a particular kind of schedule to allow me to do all of my teaching in two quarters, overload teaching in those quarters, so that I would have another one to write. So I've tried to protect my writing time, and I think you should try to protect your writing time. I think we all will have very little time to write, and I think it's something you need to make time for and take very seriously and try to protect it from all the things that happen. Now, you can ask my wife about this. She's coming next week, and she may have a slightly different answer about how I found the time to do all that writing and everything else. I've always worked 7 days a week, at least, and I always went to the office on Saturdays and spent a good 6 or 7 hours there, because I get more done in those 7 hours than I could all week long because of the necessity to interact with people the other 6 days, the other 5 days. And so, you know, so there have been sacrifices that I've made, but I thought they were worth it. And I think we both think they were worth it. But you'll get to ask her and do. But I think you get to write because you practice writing. It's like running. It's like exercising. The more you do it, better, the easier it gets. And if you get out of practice, then it's hard again. And I'm out of practice a bit, so I'm having more trouble sometimes getting things going than I used to. But I used to just write all the time. I used to come out. And then I got the carpal tunnel syndrome from so much writing, and that has slowed me down a little because I have to read what my dictation machine throws back at me. But you can't do it. I mean, you just have to do it. You can't not do it. I mean, here you're being trained. Here you're reading. Here the world is out there. Here you've got all this training in how to think and how to look at it and how to ask questions. Why not write about it? Find places. You've got a great journal. Use it. The world is filled with great journals. Use it. Blogs. Some people have blogs. I'm not sure how great they are, but some are more active than others. I mean, so use whatever there is, but think in different ways. I wrote for newspaper articles. I wrote reviews for newspapers. I wrote for all kinds of different formats.
And when you were writing them, did you know where it was going to go, or did you just like shoot first?
Usually I knew it was going to go. I get asked to write a lot of things, and so once you sort of prove that you can write it, you can do it. I have a colleague in Brazil named Roberto da Mata, who is an amazing anthropologist, and he's had a once-a-week column in the, I think it's the Folha de São Paulo, or the Estado de São Paulo, for 20 years or something like that. I mean, he is a public anthropologist in the sense that he writes about carnival. He came to the Olympic Games here in Los Angeles and was sort of the anthropologist on the ground of the Olympic Games and writing. He's an amazing sort of, he just writes. Now, some things are sort of at the edge of being stupid. On the other hand, a whole bunch of things are right at the edge of being really inside, right there, and he can sort of get the whole country thinking anthropologically. Brazil is an interesting place because it had a political scientist president once. I mean, it has a self-consciousness that is somewhat anthropological because of Gilberto Freire and a bunch of other people. So it's a country that thinks sociologically as opposed to perhaps psychologically in many areas. And Roberto is just one more example of someone who's just sort of using his anthropology to point things up in a very sort of informal and public way. You can do that too. Any other questions? You had a question.
Just the comment on the intangible. You made me do one at one time.
I did. I didn't know if you wanted to admit it. It's secret. He's admitted a secret. I would go to the grave without telling you he did that. I would be shot before telling anybody who actually reviewed their country's profile because in some cases they didn't get it. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. I think was the Iraq, I think, yeah. Right? And it's hard to know what happened because some countries changed so much and it was problematic to go and see what they did.
It was. I mean, there are some cases where everybody on the jury also knew this. No one really knew what was going to happen. But
yeah.
But that had existed once, and it was worth thinking about, and they should be proud of their past as well as their
that's
future.
That's a very, very interesting genre that I wrote about. But I think it exists, but outside the country. So sometimes the country may not, but the musicians who apply to be reviewed continue to perform, and sometimes the only venues are outside the country that we identify.
And that causes real problems for UNESCO. UNESCO is an organization of nation states. And so when something is outside of a nation state, oh my God, what do we do with it? Whose is it? And their biggest problem was in something like Uzbekistan, I think it was a certain time, Shashmakam, which is in Uzbekistan and also right across the border. And so you have the Shashmakam, who gets it and how do you proclaim it? And is so-and-so going to be really angry if so-and-so claims? It's a problem in that area, also in Europe. So there are all kinds of interesting issues that arise with nationalism, that arise with the fact that music doesn't follow national borders. I mean, countries might like to think it does, and some scholars may insist that it does, but in fact, when you look around, it's not happening that way. That's our job, is to note that, hey, it doesn't really happen that way. Maybe we need to think differently about cultural heritage, and maybe it isn't a national thing, maybe it's something else, and maybe we should recognize the role of immigrants in maintaining and safeguarding their own traditions. But yeah, thank you very much. I mean, Professor Rossi was a really good evaluator. Some evaluators I had to pursue over and over and over again to try to get them. And some people, I love them very much, but they can't write their way out of a paper bag. And so we would have to, I sort of maybe rewrote them. I have people who died in the process so I get these policies. So there are all kinds of, I'll tell you that there were things that went to UNESCO that had an awful lot more of my fingerprints on it than they should have had. But that's simply because the person who did it dropped the project. So these things are challenging, and I really appreciated people who came through and actually did what they were asked to do in the form that they were asked to do it. It was very frustrating sometimes for everybody. but it was a very creative use of writing, you have to admit. And the ICTM was getting paid for each one, and I insisted that the reviewers get paid a reasonable amount of money. I think, you know, you were getting paid $1,500 for 10 pages. Now, if you could get $1,500 for every 10 pages you write in your paper, just think, well, you are actually right now, but later when you leave the university, you're not going to get that much. So if you're adding up your fellowships and things. I think it was important for me as Secretary General of the ICTM to stand up and say, scholars need to be paid for this. This is a tremendous imposition to ask them to do something in a hurry, to use the knowledge they've acquired over a lifetime doing research that costs them immense amounts of effort. And you can't ask them to give it away. I'm proud of only a few things, but that's one of the things, that one I'm really proud of, because the money was there. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe the money was there. I mean, they said, sure, how much? So I took some office for the ICTM to keep this office, and then, yes.
I also did a couple of those evaluations and truly enjoyed it and was very happy to find out later that they were successful. But I don't know what benefit finally accrued to the nominees for
that. Something that you can find out, but I can't. I mean, that's the sort of question you would love to know. And a lot of people have asked me. So whatever happened to the project that I did? And I have secreted away the minutes of the meetings, things like that. So I know which got approved. In fact, you see that on the website. What actually happens to the artist is really hard to figure, because in so many cases, the money was coming to a ministry, and the ministry has its own priorities, and by the time it hires a filmmaker and rents a plane and gets to a place, there's really no money left to give to the actual musicians themselves. So they don't. And poor musicians themselves go there thinking they're going to get something, and they don't. But it's not the first time that's happened to them, so they just keep on playing music like they always have. But I'm cynical because I've seen budgets. I mean, one of the interesting things was to get the proposal and then see the budget. The budgets were so opposite of what the proposal was saying, in terms of what they were going to do, they just sort of held them up to each other and they sort of blew each other up. And they would say they were going to do all these great things and get the privilege the artists and do all these great things. You saw the budget, the artists weren't getting anything. All the money was being spent hiring filmmakers and anthropologists and ethnomusicologists. So that's why we have to look. I mean, that's why we do research. I'm just telling you that there's a whole lot of inconsistency out there in the world. You guys have to figure out what's going on and what to do about it.
Thank you very much.
Oh, we got one more question over here.
Tony, can you demonstrate the miniature phonographs?
Oh, the miniature phonographs. I thought the problem with today's lecture was there weren't enough musical examples. So I brought you an acoustic. I brought you an acoustic record player, which is the kind I can afford and actually moves around. And it's normally you would crank it up with this little crank here, but it's just a fake. Ooh, it seems to be doing something, but actually it's the battery that does it. And it plays like this and plays. Whoop! It'd help if I pointed it toward you, wouldn't it? All right, this is a song that you probably know about an old gray mare. Aren't I glad I came out of the wilderness is where that song came from. And there's a song, the reason I brought it today was because this is President's Week. And there's a song, Old Abe Lincoln came out of the wilderness, out of the wilderness, out of the wilderness. Old Abe Lincoln came out of the wilderness many long years ago. Many long years ago, many long years ago. Old Abe Lincoln came out of the wilderness many long years ago. So I was going to sing you the presidential song. That's a demonstration, a lecture, and a performance all at once. Thanks so much. Come in 2 weeks.